stock markets today are extremely volatile, even more so than in the past few years. In-depth investing with Gavin Graham helps to cut through the confusion. Gavin and his contributors, including expert analysts, journalists, advisors, and financial executives, can help. In each edition of this podcast, they cut to the core of the matter and suggest strategies to consider for selecting your investments and for keeping them safe and intact. And now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Welcome to In-Depth Investing with Gavin Graham. I'm Gavin Graham, and with my contributors in various areas around the world, I'll bring you literally in-depth investment analysis of the impact of global events, unfortunately many of them regarded as crises, on your investments and your financial health. You can be forgiven for listening to the investment news these days and feeling somewhat worried, or maybe that you have to retreat from the stock market, or perhaps raise cash. You can also be forgiven for wondering where the market and your investment are headed after hearing the day's news. I've been handling investors' money for 35 years in several continents and half a dozen countries. My own belief about the current investment climate is that the markets undoubtedly are looking somewhat expensive. This is a very long-lasting bull market. We're coming up to 10 years now from the depths of the financial crisis in 2009. And there are certainly evidence of some pockets of irrational exuberance, as Alan Greenspan once described it. Having said that, there are still underlying factors that make the markets not necessarily unattractive. In fact, there are several areas that do continue to look attractive, and the central banks have the markets back. They are starting to cut rates, whether it's in North America or in Europe, and they are determined to ensure that there is support for financial assets. To help you with the present situation and to try to make sense of some of the confusion, I bring in analysts, advisors, and journalists from various parts of the world, and we'll look at the impact of these various events on your money. The financial crisis of 2008-9, which I mentioned, and the crises in the meantime since then, along with the constant attention paid to changes in interest rates, announcements by the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and other central banks, has led to the belief that central banks have an outsized impact on share prices. My first guest today says that's not really the case. In fact, he says the US Federal Reserve is losing at least some of its potency. I have Paul DeSisto on the line from New York, where he's Executive Vice President and Managing Partner of M&R Capital. Thanks for coming in, Paul.
Thank you for inviting me, Graham.
Not to worry. Do you think that a number of commentators exaggerate the impact of central banks on share prices?
It's kind of yes and no, Gavin. I still believe that the Kena syndrome, there is no alternative to stocks, still exists.
Yep.
Because the rates are so low. And I was looking online here. I saw some pictures in some German newspapers of Senor Draghi. They made him look like a vampire with vampire teeth because he was sucking out the value of savers with his low interest rates. And he's now being roundly criticized for lowering interest rates as much as he did, particularly his last lowering. The German central banker, Weidmann, got quite upset about it. So I don't know if that answers your question. It's clear that the effectiveness of central banks is declining simply because there's just not as much room left anymore. Draghi's recommendation to Madame Lagarde was to go ahead and start urging these governments to start doing some fiscal spending. The reason the United States has not had the slowing economy to the extent that its major trading partners in Europe and Japan have had, simply because we have the tailwind of the Tax Act of 2017, and the European nations and Japan, they don't have that. And of course, China's in a way is in a world of its own. So,
indeed. But would it be therefore fair to say that while the effect that the central bank's policies on share prices may have been diminished a lot by the fact that interest rates are so low, that would obviously have a much greater effect on bond prices, which are effectively almost entirely priced off what the shape of the interest rate curve is?
That is indeed the case. But if you go back to the interest rate, the curve of the interest rates, we had the situation, the panic, I guess, about 7 months ago, where we were going into a recession, possibly because of the inversion. The Fed quickly replaced that. A lot of people felt they overshot in 2018 with 4 increases. So now we're back down 3 decreases, 1.5% to 1.75%. We're a positive yield curve. But the longer rates continue to stay low, and it's the longer rates which are making mortgages and automobile financing and all those sort of things possible. And that is why it's really the U.S. consumer, more so than capital spending, which is keeping the economy in this country going as well as it is.
But if that's the case, and the U.S. consumer is probably in about as good a position as they've been for many, many years, with unemployment at 50-year lows, and there's even actually some wage increases now starting to come through, if that starts to get weaker from here, which evidence would seem to indicate, given how long we've been going, would be likely, the problem, you would say, is that the Fed has fewer tools to fight it than last time?
I would agree with that, Gavin, very much so, because they have, you're down to 1.5% to 1.75%. What else can you do? Well, you can do the quantitative easing, but the Fed said they want really to avoid doing that as a permanent feature. They would rather just keep liquidity on the short term available, which is why they're doing all the repos and so forth. They specifically said in their October 12th meetings that they did not want to manage the debt of the United States government. They wanted the Treasury to do it. So QE may not be as available, as well as you don't have the availability to lower short-term rates as well either. So again, it's got to be a fiscal stimulus, and that's certainly what a lot of people in Europe are saying. And so Germany, they actually did eke out a 0.1% growth in GDP last quarter by the skin of their teeth, and it was not by exports within the European Union, it was by exports to the United States. So they have their own problems there too.
They do, and of course, with the potential of tariffs being imposed on EU exports to the US, that's another worry for them. But I think the last time we spoke on this podcast, you suggested strongly that a recession is not likely in the immediate future in the States. Would you still hold for that belief? And if so, what do you think the most likely path forward is from here?
I'm not suggesting to any clients that they lighten up on equities. I think they have to be a little bit more precise. I wouldn't just buy the market haphazardly. We were bumping up against resistance here, but we did break into a new high last week. I still believe in the TINA situation. There is no alternative with interest rates doing what they're doing. What we have to avoid is what Governor Carney called a liquidity trap, where you have low interest rates, but you have high savings rates. And the U.S. consumers, he's spending or she's spending now. So we're going to avoid that problem there. So I feel pretty good going forward with investing in equity securities. I'm really not thrilled about fixed income securities at all of any sort, high yield or quality or government. I just don't think that's the place to go.
Indeed. So the other wild card we have on the horizon, of course, in under a year's time now, is the US presidential election. There have been worries that especially the more, socialist wing of the Democratic Party, people like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, if they were to actually end up winning the nomination and winning the election, the market would react pretty badly because of the large increases in government spending and taxation that would be involved. Do you believe that that's a major worry for the market, and would that lead you to suggest people being a bit more cautious, or do you feel that that is something that the market can ride through?
If these politicians on the far left were able to institute such policies, it would be a problem. However, I don't believe they would be able to do some of the things that they're advocating. I just don't think it would pass. Adam Smith said 300 years ago, there's a lot of ruin in a country, and some of the policies we had during the previous administration were deleterious to economic growth, but the economy finds ways to work around these restrictions and so forth. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. I know it is a headline risk for a very, very short term. One of the more left-leaning candidates may get be the front runner for a day or two, but then that's pretty quickly receives into the background is no longer a factor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Paul. That's a reassuring assessment of where we are in terms of the economic cycle and where people should be putting their money. But obviously, I'll hope to come back to you on a fairly regular basis to see how things are going. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Gavin.
So that was Paul DeSisto from New York, where he's Executive Vice President and Managing Partner of M&R Capital. And I think it's fair to say that central banks as a whole, to Paul's major point, the ammunition they have is much more limited than the last time round because interest rates in absolute terms are so low. In fact, in Japan and in Europe, they're negative. A third of all developed market government bonds are negatively yielding. That is, you have to pay the government to hold your money, which is a completely anomalous situation. But what it does do is remove the ability of central banks to use monetary policy to stimulate in the event of a downturn. We are going to be a lot more reliant on fiscal policy. One of the issues coming out of this is that if that ends up with more money printing and more inflation, that what other assets could protect your investments? Gold and precious metals are one of the areas where people are feeling perhaps it's a good idea to have some exposure to it. If you are concerned about the volatility of gold itself, you could look at the shares of gold mining companies, although to be fair, they generally tend to be somewhat more volatile than gold itself because they are a leveraged play on the volatility of the earnings that they generate as the price of gold goes up and down. But to talk about that, we have Chris Mancini on the line from New York, where he's mining and metals analyst at Gabelli Fund. Chris, thanks very much for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So first, looking at gold prices, which do seem to actually have broken out of that five-year bear market that they entered somewhere around 2011-12, what would your outlook be for 2020 as far as the gold price is concerned and from that gold stocks?
I think gold's an interest rate story at this point in time, like you were talking about in terms of negative rates. The ultimate play, I think, for gold or the next phase would be the market starting to price in a probability of... hello?
Yeah, still there.
Sorry about that. So I think that ultimately the question is the probability of interest rates going negative in the United States, like they are in Germany and various European countries and Japan. And so I think to the degree that the market prices in a higher probability of negative rates in the US, gold goes up. And if the market starts to price in a lower probability, gold goes down. And those probabilities will be a function of economic growth. And so if the US economy grows, then I think and there's a view that the Fed's going to actually start to raise rates again, I think gold goes down and vice versa. So that, again, that doesn't give you an answer as to where I think it'll go, because then I'd have to give you a
interest rate
yeah.
Well, actually, exactly. I think it's fair to say, and from the previous conversation with Paul DeSisto, the interest rates are moving down at present. Certainly the Fed's reversal at the beginning of this year is one of the reasons I think most observers feel we've seen such a strong market. But it's interesting that, in fact, gold itself has done fairly well. I think we're up about, 12%, and the gold stocks in general, looking at the movement over the last year, are up in the sort of 30 to 40% increases, which would seem to indicate that generally observers think that the likely direction of interest rates is down. In terms of gold itself, obviously we're still below where we were, 6-7 years ago. Do you think that gold looks relatively cheap in relation to its historic levels and to the output, the outlook for diminished output by gold mines?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the big picture, again, I think that that if we do go back to quantitative easing or negative rates in the United States, I think that gold goes a lot higher. And I think it goes through that $1,900 an ounce or $2,000 an ounce level. So I think that but the question again is how do we get there? And it is a function of the direction of rates. And so so I think that from a big picture perspective, it is speculators that are driving the gold price now. And I think that they're the ones who'll take gold through 2000. And again, that'll just be a function of which direction rates go. And again, pricing in a probability of more QE or negative rates in the U.S.
So moving away from the metal itself, you mentioned gold miners and tending to be something of a leveraged play on the gold price, as evidenced by the fact that most gold miners are up a lot more than gold itself this year. Which ones, in terms of the large cap gold miners, would you think look particularly interesting over the next year or so?
I think that Newmont looks the most interesting of the large cap gold mining companies. So the Newmont Gold Corp. So Newmont just acquired Gold Corp in April of this year. The Gold Corp assets were undercapitalized. They were undermanaged. Newmont management has done a great job of bringing costs down at all of their mines since the bear market started in 2013. So I think that they're going to apply the methodology that they apply to their own assets, to the Gold Corp assets. I think that they'll stabilize those assets, and I think they'll optimize those assets, and I think they'll start to generate a lot of free cash flow. And I think they'll be able to pay a bigger dividend. So I think that that's a company that in a flat gold price could be up a good 25%. And then as you're saying, if the gold price does go up, then it'll have the leverage associated with having such a large production base over a fixed cost base. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity in Newmont if it can execute on its Gold Corp acquisition, which I think it will.
Indeed. It's interesting that with that Gold Corp acquisition, Newmont's actually been a little bit of a laggard so far over the last year. It's up about 17%, but it's actually doubled over the last 5 years, which obviously is a tribute to the quality of Newmont's management, as you said. Would there be another company that you think might be worth looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Detour Gold, that's not a large cap. Detour Gold is a kind of maybe a mid cap, but that has Detour owns, it's a single asset company, you know, it's the largest gold mine in Canada, which is the Detour Lake Mine in Northern Ontario, produces around 625,000 ounces of gold per year, again, on a fixed cost base. The new management's come in and they've done a good job of showing how they can actually increase throughput at the mine over the fixed cost base, and then also reduce the fixed costs. And so they're starting to implement a plan. The new management was put in place, I think, the beginning of this year, end of last year. The plan is coming into place, and as they're able to execute, the company should start to generate a lot of free cash flow. It has a 22-year mine life, so it does have really good leverage to the upside as well. Because if gold prices do start to go up, the market will start to price in higher gold prices in the future, in, you know, year 10 or year 20 of the mine's life, and so the market will, the stock will price in positive optionality to the gold price. So we like Detour too.
Indeed, and one of the attractions, of course, is its Canadian location. It always helps to have a stable political environment if you're looking 15 or 20 years out for a mine.
Yeah, for sure. So that's a huge factor. A stable rule of law, and you know, no risk of any kind of really super crazy stuff happening in Canada. Some crazy stuff, nothing too extreme, I don't think. We can get into that discussion later about the current government, But it's a stable jurisdiction where we know what we're going to get.
Now, that's very attractive. Well, thanks very much indeed, Chris. Appreciate those insights. And again, a couple of particular stocks that might well do okay, even in the absence of a strong upward move in the price of the metal itself. Thanks. And I'm sure we'll be talking again.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. So that was Chris Mancini, who's mining and metals analyst at Gabelli Funds in New York. And the major point, I think, to take away from that is that it really is a call on your view on interest rates. If you think that the price of gold is likely to be substantially higher through the $1,900, $2,000 an ounce level, which is where it peaked out in 2011-12. But that even if you don't believe that's likely to happen, there are companies such as the two that Chris mentioned, Newmont Gold Corp and Detour, which have the ability to actually grow their production even without a rise in the gold price. So now, having talked about the the gold area, let's move to an area which some people regard as being almost as valuable as gold, which is the media sector and the battle being fought for consumer dollars in your living room and on your various electronic devices. The good news is that consumers will have more choice than ever as to how they spend their entertainment dollars. The bad news is that it's questionable whether all these options can survive the brutal competition that's unfolding. To get an update on the streaming wars, I have our Hollywood correspondent, Shari Williams, on the line. Thanks for coming in today, Shari.
Oh, of course.
So we know that Disney, in effect, threw its own kind of gauntlet down in the streaming wars with Disney Plus. How has Apple responded?
Well, Apple wants to bundle its paid internet services, including News Plus, Apple TV Plus, and Apple Music, so that they can get more subscribers because the smartphone market is kind of stagnant. And they've already started offering free Apple TV Plus subscriptions to students who are Apple Music subscribers.
So how's that been going for Apple so far?
Well, unfortunately, the amount of revenue they've received from Apple News Plus so far has been less than what they expected. It's kind of unclear whether publishers are seeing less profit because Apple News has fewer subscribers or because their content isn't being widely read. Advertisers have been less interested in Apple News Plus because of their restrictive data policies. It's making it more difficult for them to target specific readers.
Wow. So in other words, that you can't monetize the eyeballs that you're getting on Apple News Plus in the same way as you can on other streaming services. Is that making Apple's relationships with media companies a little bit uncertain?
Well, as part of the contract, media companies have the right to pull magazines and newspapers from Apple News Plus after a year if they're not happy with the service. The media industry fears that their readers might cancel existing subscriptions and get other articles at a cheaper price. Still, some news executives are pleased with how Apple News Plus has gone so far, and they're optimistic that they will continue to grow in the months and years ahead. But not all of them. Some did not make all of their articles and magazines available, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. They didn't even sign up.
Well, of course, the Washington Post's owner, Mr. Bezos, does have some skin in this fight with Amazon, I suppose. But moving on from specifically Apple itself, would it be fair to say that the streaming wars, which we talked about last time, are heating up and that there's going to be even more of a scramble going on for subscribers?
Streaming providers like Netflix, Apple TV+, Disney+, AT&T, HBO are allowing subscribers to sign up, watch a new show, and then cancel if they want. But they're using programming, promotions, and other strategies to avoid those cancellations. Disney has the advantage of making content for children, of course. Netflix, HBO, Max, Apple TV Plus have invested in kids' content to keep subscribers from canceling while they wait for the next original adult-focused show.
So getting back to Apple, what are its chances in the streaming wars, or at least some battles within it?
Well, Apple TV Plus, with its new ad-free subscription service, could potentially rival Netflix original programs if it can match their extensive output. So far, we don't know how much new content is coming, but Apple's new streaming service has slightly undercut Netflix's monthly subscription cost at $4.99, and a subscription can be shared with up to 6 family members. And also, the cheapest Netflix plan is currently $9, so both are pretty competitive, but a little more than Disney Plus price. Apple wants to rival Netflix with its own original programming through Apple TV Plus, but it doesn't look like they'll be able to match their sheer volume unless they can release new content every month and get some original or syndicated movies into the platform.
So if that's the case, and we know that content is king, as we're always being told, where does it leave Apple in the streaming wars?
Well, for now, Apple TV Plus won't offer any licensed content at all. You still have to buy those shows a la carte, but they could prove a problem to Netflix in terms of quality. Apple has a strong lineup of famous creatives behind its original programming, and its real focus is on high-quality content. And with Disney's own Disney Plus streaming services having landed, the question of streaming supremacy will likely only get harder to answer.
Well, thank you very much, Shari, for that excellent summary of where we are now. But this is such a rapidly changing space that we'll obviously be having to revisit fairly frequently. I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. Thanks very much indeed.
Bye.
So it is fair to note that Disney, for example, which has launched its Disney Plus streaming service, which is undercutting Netflix, is actually up 30% this year and around 60% over the last 5 years. So that's obviously been a fairly impressive performance. And Disney does have that massive library of content, particularly children's programming, which for anyone with children, as you'll know, having the electronic babysitter in the corner is a very, very valuable tool to have. So having talked about Apple and Netflix, those are, of course, two of the group of stocks often referred to as the FANGs. That's Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, whose parent company is now called Alphabet. The FANGs have been the major reason why the stock market has been so strong over the last 5 years. The rise in their stock prices has resulted in four of them becoming amongst the 10 largest listed companies by market capitalization globally at the time of writing. Apple being the second biggest at 4.2% of the S&P 500, just behind Microsoft at 4.3%. Alphabet is third at 3%, Amazon fourth at 2.9%, and Facebook is fifth at 1.8%. Netflix actually is the odd one out here because it's only the 40th largest company at 0.5% of the S&P 500. Put them all together and they comprise almost one-seventh of the stock market, a remarkable feat for companies, four of which didn't even exist 25 years ago. Over the last 5 years, their performance has been even more remarkable as they were already pretty large companies in 2014. Netflix is the smallest, now worth about $130 billion or so. So its 500% increase in price over the period is perhaps understandable, but for Amazon to go up 420% to reach a market capitalization of $870 billion is amazing. Alphabet, Apple, and Facebook, which are up only 130 to 150% over the period, are relative laggards. The S&P and 500 and the MSCI World Indices are up 50% each in the same period, and the Toronto Stock Exchange barely 20%, reflecting how much the FANG stocks have outperformed and how much of the rise in the broad indices are due to their strong performance. The reason for that performance is fairly obvious. They're all growing very rapidly, and perhaps even more important, they're pretty profitable too, a rare combination for which investors are willing to pay a very high price. Facebook's five-year average revenue growth is 48%, and its profit growth, an almost unbelievable 71%. Netflix, five-year revenue and profits growth are 29 and 61%, respectively. Amazon's 25% and 105%, and Alphabet's 18% and 20%. Only Apple's growth in revenues and profits are lagging and are relatively pedestrian, in fact, only up 7% each. The rise in their earnings, however, has been more than outpaced by the rise in the stock price, meaning they're all pretty expensive. Netflix's price-earnings ratio for 2018 is 96.6, and given all the money it's spending on the content that Shari was talking about, 141 times this year. Amazon's 2018-19 PEs are 78 and 106 times, respectively, again, reflecting the expense of expanding its Amazon Prime delivery service. Alphabet and Facebook are more lowly valued at around 26 and 32 times, respectively, for 2018. Only Apple at 23 times 2018 earnings, falling to 18 times this year, appears to represent reasonable value. The major factor to be aware of for all of these stocks is that they are largely driven by consumer spending, whether it's advertising in the case of Google and Facebook, or satisfying consumer needs like Amazon and Netflix. Apple, in fact, is the odd one out because it's a manufacturer of hardware, even though it's very desirable hardware. So the major factor to be aware of is that when the market does turn down, even if it may not happen in the immediate future, given the support of falling interest rates, these stocks are fairly vulnerable. And the last time we saw a major sell-off at the end of the tech boom in 1999 to 2000, Apple and Amazon, the two listed companies, were down a lot more than the index's 50% fall. In fact, 75% and 95% respectively. Therefore, it's never wrong to take a profit. It might well be sensible if you have some exposure to these stocks, either directly or via your market-weighted exchange-traded fund, that you might want to lock in some profits. Having said that, I should remind you to check with your financial advisor about all investment decisions as to their viability and suitability for your own situation. And thank you very much for listening to the podcast. That wraps up this edition of Investing in Depth with Gavin Graham. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emmett. You'll soon be able to find the book edition of this program on Amazon, whether podcast or printed version or both. We hope you find our information useful. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks for listening to this edition of In-Depth Investing with Gavin Graham. Be sure to check out the book version of this podcast on Amazon. And please join us again for more in-depth investing.